You're listening to Confessing Animals with Jen Harris and Vanessa Arrico, rebel poets, real rebels, really talking poets, rebelling and listening.
Okay, don't interrupt me.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to another episode of Confessing Animals podcast. I'm Jen Harris.
And I'm Vanessa Arrico.
And we are bringing you an interim episode. So you're going to get a lot of hot goss, a lot of new information today. But before we tell you what's in the episode, we've got some new shit to tell you about. So, yes. Vanessa, what do we have to tell them?
Yeah. Season 3 is coming up, and we will start releasing that on September 7th. So it's going to be a whole new season. We're going to have a whole new theme. We're going to have all new guests. And we're branching out from WWKC. So we're going to have a couple guests that are not part of our writing workshop. We're expanding the circle. So I'm really excited about having some new people, introducing people to some great new artists that we know.
Yeah, these people are in our community. Most of them are Kansas City local. We're still recording online on Zoom because of the current state of the world. So just thought we'd reach out and see who else is doing stuff in this second year of the most quarantining I've ever done.
And we're all fucking exhausted, and we know that this is all ridiculous. And, you know, we're zoomed out, but we got to keep doing this. There's no other safe way to do this right now. And we want to continue the podcast, and I want to continue to be involved with people and writers and artists and thinkers. And having these conversations, I think, is helping me a lot personally. I'm hoping that it's bringing some kind of thought or release or joy or happiness or, you know, some kind of provocation
connectivity
into your life. Yeah,
absolutely. Yeah. I want it to be bringing all those things. I also don't want people to feel alone. I want to clarify what you mean by ridiculous in that I assume you mean to say it's all ridiculous because, Jesus Christ, if we could all just get on board and do the right thing, it would be, I wouldn't say over by now, but a lot more under control than it is. And this is really
right. And a lot safer. Like, yeah, ridiculous. And just like, I kind of just feel like we're back to the beginning. You know what I mean? Like, I feel we all were like, oh, 2020 happened, and like the pandemic was only relegated to 2020. And now that's 2021, like it's all just back to life, and it's just not happening. You know, it's really scary. Unfortunately, we're in Missouri. It's a very under-vaccinated, under-caring kind of place for this current kind of issue. So it's hard on everybody. We all want to be together. Summertime. Summer's going to end. I mean, you know, it's hard. It's hard, but we're still, you know, in a privileged position to be able to make stuff like this. So hopefully, you know, you guys like it.
Yeah, I agree. And that, you know, you're not in it by yourself. You know, that we're here doing this. It was born definitely of WWKC, but also of our availability related to the initial quarantine. And it's such a fucking American idea, right? To be like, pandemic, that was so 2020. Like,
oh,
a bunch
I know,
of
right?
Cunts we are. Hate us.
I know. It's like we're all, it's like, so last season, it's all in fashion. Like, we speak in these like cultural cycles like we're on a news feed. And it's just like, real life doesn't work like that, guys.
No, it does not work like that. So we're going to continue with season 3, and you're going to hear about how goddamn trapped we are in our houses. And that's just that you're listening. So that's your problem.
But so like we decided, oh no, didn't mean to interrupt you.
No, it's okay. You go ahead, sugar.
Oh my God, baby. Okay. So we decided to go with revenge and redemption. This is the theme of season 3. It's one of the great literary themes. I don't know how we landed there, but this is where we landed. And I think it's kind of two great bookends for people to be able to talk about their life and their work and what they've been creating.
Totally. We're going to incorporate some new formatting. Like Vanessa said, we're going to have new guests. And also we have a new Patreon page. Initially, when we started this off, we didn't know where it would go. So we took things kind of slow as far as getting it out to the public. And now we've reached a listenership level where our own Patreon, separate of my business or your business, became necessary. So you can find Confessing Animals podcast on patreon.com. It's patreon.com/confessinganimalspodcast. It's going to be all over all of our social media, so you can check that out there. And let's see. Yeah, September 7th, we're going to bring you some really good shit. In the interim of that, We had a conversation today because I went and saw the Anthony Bourdain documentary Roadrunner, and I was so completely blown away by, inspired by, deeply moved, entirely disturbed, and I just really wanted to take that out on Vanessa, so we decided to record it.
Yeah, it was a great spontaneous conversation. It inspired Jen to write, so she shares a piece of her writing with us. But it just fit kind of right into our theme of like revenge and redemption and creativity and life and, you know, that fine line between life and art.
Absolutely. It definitely is a big old spoiler. So if you're going to see Roadrunner, like if you're one of those people who's like, I'm going to go see it in the theater, by the way, wear your mask if you're going to the theater. But if you're going to go see it in the theater, don't listen to this episode. And if you're going to watch it eventually, listen to this episode, because it conjures up a lot of big questions we as a collective creative community are asking ourselves. It's also a conversation about mental health. It's a conversation about philosophies and ideologies as related to the artist, artist capital A, you know. There's so many twists and turns to this documentary because Anthony Bourdain was a complex person with a complex life and a complex death. So, yes. I mean, revenge and redemption, we couldn't really start any better way. So I guess exactly. This is technically episode zero.
Right.
Of season three.
I hope you guys like it. Yeah. I enjoyed this conversation so much. I was rejuvenated by it. I've really missed podcasting with you. I've missed our conversations. I miss the magic that happens when you and I just hit record and whatever comes out of our silly mouths.
Totally. Well, now we're done hiding in the desert and in the woods for the summer. So I guess we'll just get back to work.
I know.
But okay. Guys, we love you. We're really excited to release season three of Confessing Animals podcast on September 7th with the themes of revenge and redemption. We're going to have new guests that aren't on the podcast or aren't in WWKC. So you're going to get to hear from fresh voices. And we have a new Patreon, patreon.com/confessing animals podcast. Please go sign up to subscribe. It's $5 a month to support the pod. And we would really love your input. So feel free to leave us any comments or send us an email, whatever makes you happy.
Yes. Listen to us, love us, talk to us.
Share everything. Us with your friends. We're trying so desperately to keep our heads above water. All right, you ready to get into this?
Let's do it.
Yesterday, I went and saw Roadrunner, the Anthony Bourdain documentary at Screenland Armor, and it was just us. Eventually, these two old biddies that were like, they were 20 minutes late to the documentary, and they were old and loud as fuck. Like, they're just jingling around with like a bunch of, like, I don't know if they have candy in their fucking purses or they're made of plastic. I don't know what's going on.
Right.
But they were very crinkly, and... They came in and watched the movie too. But we saw this movie and it was so fucking incredible. Like they did the movie justice, and then I did not know anything about his personality or his life experience, his impact. Like, of course he's in the periphery of my celebrity like awareness, but I never really dive into shit like that. Like I'm not intentionally counterculture. I'm just like worried about my own shit a lot. So
yeah,
I was not following Anthony Bourdain during his life. And in like the first 10 minutes, they're talking to a friend of his and they're basically like saying like, we don't want you to make a documentary about his suicide because his legacy, the truth of his life is so much more, it's so much more interesting. It's so much more intentional. Like his legacy is all of these things. And then they kind of start the movie, and for like an hour and a half, I'm just in it with this guy in all of his truth and all of his struggles. I mean, his very like Greek god starving body, like just how the fuck did I even wind up here from being a junkie and which I didn't know about him, from being a junkie and a line cook to like being fucking Anthony Bourdain. And they don't hide anything, but they like they made sure to present his truth in its entirety, and I was so swept away by it. It was so incredible. Like,
I love that.
We should all be so fucking lucky for someone to make a documentary about us at the end of our lives that tells the truth of us. And absolutely, it was so good. And then I wrote like crazy.
Oh, I see. That's like my main love of watching documentaries like that, is like what it provokes in me. And like, I love that you went home and wrote, because like I watched the trailer and I was swept away. Like, I knew a lot about Anthony Bourdain. Like, I didn't like, I haven't read his books. I like never had TV, right, so I didn't watch his show regularly, but I have seen his shows. I know about his persona. Like, I know his, but like, to me, it always just breaks my heart because this dude lived life. Like, mm-hmm, he went to all these amazing places, met these amazing people, ate this amazing food in these beautiful places, right? He had money, he had ability, like, and it still wasn't enough. And that's what breaks my heart. At the very end, even when you have the money and the means and your life seems cush, you have this daughter, you have, like, that, it's still, he still killed himself. What is that? You know what I mean? And that's the ultimate question of our life, whether it's Camus saying, you know, like, why do we get up and decide to live every day? It's like not even a question of like killing yourself. It's like we're actively deciding to live every day. And when we have so little and you see someone with so much and you're like, wow, that wasn't even enough. Like, what is that? What's that?
Girl, please let me, can I please read you what I wrote? Because please, like, on point. Okay, let me grab it. Hang on. What if I just pulled like a binder out? No, this notebook. Okay. I'm going to read you this because what you're saying is on point for not seeing it. And then like, I want to share it with you. So because I fucking loved it. I loved what it brought out in me, because he has this like Hemingway, Hunter S. Thompson, kind of virility and demand in his words, like his the narration of his books, seemingly he's a very direct, you know, like in that stark presented way that Hemingway was just like writing a true sentence, so there was no bullshit around it. But he had this Kerouac tenderness to him that I just like, I wrote about it in this, not specifically to that particular like reference of Kerouac, but like the tenderness of him and what I deduced happened from what I learned about him. Okay. Our first movie together about an artist in our lifetime, a great artist, a meaningful and accidental one whose legacy ended in suicide. No one's gotten, forgotten, or forgiven. No one's gotten over, forgotten, or forgiven. The film gave that up first thing, not pussyfooting around what they knew the audience was chomping at the bit for them to get to. They bring it up and they drop it for an hour and a half because fuck you, that's why. The manner of death should not define the man, should not shroud a deeply personal impact and an ever-evolving legacy. Look at him, even though he only sometimes wanted you to. Now, look now and know he feels unseen. Born with a pinprick murmur in the King of Hearts. That's what got infected with a certainty of being unlovable. He pulled an airtight cover over that manhole, leaving it susceptible to creativity and a slow molding rot, dying on the inside from what cannot be absorbed about the external. My girlfriend rocked and gasped, nodded in praise, rocked and chugged, held tighter, pulled away, wept. We sat there, air conditioned to our skeletons, and witnessed the eulogy of his friend's remembrances. The two biddies behind us were paralyzed for the first time since their late and clunky arrival. We watched until there were no words left and left before they did. The thick humidity of Missouri in July welcomes us. We stand at the curbside patio and hug until it feels holy, trying to promise one another we'll never think about suicide again if the other doesn't. But we don't say any of that. And besides, neither of us believes it anyway. It seems more likely that we'll both do our best. maybe it's Bourdain's influence lingering in my half-stoned mind, or maybe it's the sunset and there's nothing but open tables on the shady side of the street, or most obviously, it's that I'm in love with another writer, a beautiful woman who opened the French doors of my heart so gently that now I write complete sentences rather than fragments of poetry. The tables are sturdy, sticky gray plastic, toned down accents to the ballpark mustard barriers barely separating us from traffic. I order her a kombucha that feels like a beer, a soda water thick with lime pulp and a salty buttered popcorn we'd refrain from during the beginning of the movie. The real show's out here, I say to her as I unload the bounty like a pack mule in a land I've only seen through Tony's lens. She knows what I mean. The real challenge is left up to us now. How to derive meaning from life in a world that makes it damn near impossible to want to keep on living. I think it's about love. This is about love. It's all about love. Hold on, because it's the only thing worth living for at all. So maybe it's up to both of us now.
Oh my God. There was so much in that. This is so funny. I never expected Bourdain to be our watchful eye over this new conversation we're having, but you kind of mentioned him having like this Greek god kind of, I don't know, statuesque or sound or just like this persona or whatever, but
he had a presence and a command, yeah, that was presented, because he wasn't in any way seemingly gluttonous. Like, he kept proclaiming in all of his gruffness how lucky he was, how
right
this was not the way life was supposed to go.
And I love, too, that, like, he was seemingly, like, this cool guy, but he didn't make anyone feel excluded, I feel like. There was no, like, exclusionary, like, whatever, like, I'm the cool guy, here's the line, you know what I mean? Like, right, he was still very open and humble and, like, aware that this was all insane, whatever he was doing, that, like, this is happening to me, what?
Well, and he came across as someone who never really experienced him in any way, didn't have the time or energy or interest in developing an understanding of who he was or his persona. Like, he just seemed so aware that this was uncharacteristically extraordinary and that he was willing to try anything creatively. And I think that started in the kitchen and like worked its way through his whole career. But he didn't pretend that he was okay. It was just so obvious he also didn't know. Like, sometimes there are no words for the level of suffering you're experiencing. Like, you can't remember the origin. You just feel the ache kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And, like, I think that's really what they circled around at the end of the documentary because, you know, they make no qualms to hide the fact that he was in a relationship with someone and this tabloid came out basically saying that she was fucking around on him and there were all these photos. And he had done all of these cinematic inclusions in his previous work where like the movies that influenced him as a young man would get fused in the transition. So if he was emulating like a Western he'd seen, and then they cut to the shot where he's like literally living out this dream of some cinematic memory. His last Instagram post is like a tribute to this revenge movie. And basically this person kills himself at the end to get back at their lover for breaking their heart. And so they literally like he, in a moment of desperation, in true form to his nature, completely overreacting, he fucking sought revenge. He jumped. And I think the thing, hi Ramona. I think the thing about it is that he always jumped. There was never an in between. There was never it was either mania and complete joy or total rejected sadness, which right. then, I mean, kind of makes him like a, it kind of cements him in this whole tortured artist, martyred ideology that we are like actively trying to dispel on this fucking podcast. But at the same time, like, God damn it. Is it just true that right. we are inclined to suffer to the degree of death and like to prove how deeply we feel? Or is this something that like, once we finally get the root out of our system, it will die for good? Like I feel very conflicted about how to answer that question now, because I really thought it was possible to like flush this fucking infection out. And then I'm like, oh no, are we born destined to be dramatic?
Right. Is this the an inherent human, I don't know if I want to say flaw, but like, are we born at this, right? Like, and this to me speaks a lot to the blurring of the lines of art and life, right? Like if he's living out and kind of like, weaving in the cinematic influences, interactions, and here's my final gesture. That's like the ultimate performance, right?
Right. Well, and it's like a, if this is the only, if this is a place that I have in me that is so sacred and so relevant, and like, you know, art imitates life, life informs art. And so they reference that in the documentary in that, is he living out art? Is he creating art? Was his final gesture truly in fact a performance, or was it the tragic end that we're all destined to meet in one way or another as creatives? Right. And I mean, that open-ended question I think remains, because, you know, as we get sober, as we get better, as we go to therapy, as we work on healing ourselves, you know, we know that the myth is dispelled that you can only create from the depth of misery, right? Like mm-hmm. Everything is a spectrum. Everything has extremes. But I think that we waning addicts and idiots, like really, you start to miss the edge that you had at some point. And like that, I mean, at least for me, that edge is always kind of a craving. Mm-hmm. And so I don't want to dismiss and dispel the truth of that. But like, is it ever possible that it goes away?
Yeah, I'm glad that they chose not to include Aja in the film, because I think it would have overshadowed him and his life. I'm glad they did speak about that, though. I mean,
that's the end of the story. There's like, right, if like they didn't it. Include like, it at all, it would be a totally, it would allow the public to continue speculating. Like,
right.
You know, why did he do this? What, you know, what did he get a diagnosis? Did he get a, you know, something?
Right. Is this
terrifying?
Depression? Like, and I wonder, like, if Anthony Bourdain did not become the character Anthony Bourdain, like, if he was always just like a line cook or chef, if he never had fame or notoriety in the television show, would he have met the same end? Would he have still been depressed? Would he have still been heartbroken? Would he still have taken his life? You know what I mean? Are you still an artist when nobody is fucking watching? Or do you do the ultimate performance because you're being observed?
I think this is an incredible question. They said in the documentary, because Octavia, his second wife, who's the mother of his child, you know, they someone said in the documentary, Octavia and their daughter seemed to be a detour on his impending trajectory, I think is how they framed it. And I initially negatively reacted to that, because I was like, don't call a woman and her child and that family a detour. But I think what they ultimately concluded was like, that was the thing that kept him alive longer, that this seemed in retrospect potentially inevitable, solely because he did it anyway. You know what I mean? Right. He
but that was like the off ramp that kind of kept it going longer.
Right. Well, and it's like he and his first wife, Nancy, were together almost 30 years, and they didn't interview her either. Like, they had this very, like, young love. They were, you know, they were together young. They stayed together for a long time. And then he changed, they changed. You know what I mean? Like, when it's just you and your partner living this life, and then all of a sudden your partner grows in a totally different direction and very tall. And I'm sure that that was its own mess. But, like, you know, then he marries someone else and becomes a father, which was seemingly something he had not projected possible for himself until that point. As somebody who's coming into the experience of having children in my life, like significantly later, as my friends are saying goodbye to their kids graduating high school, you know, I'm dating someone who has children, and I didn't want that for myself. As far as like, I never chose parenting. I actively chose not being a parent. So I can see how, in your evolution and seeing the world, that you will change. Like, that's the risk of growing, right? Like, being willing to grow means you're not coming back the same person.
Right.
So it seemed like those first two relationships were so loving and stable, but at some point, you know, he was no longer in the current of his creativity and was in more of like the white raft, the white waters of depression and anxiety and pressure and performance. And when you can't go anywhere without being recognized, there is no peace, right. You know, because you're constantly interacting with people who are projecting what they need onto your iconography. And like,
right. Did they allude to like, did he have any kind of like underlining philosophy about, I don't know, just about like life. Like, did he believe in reincarnation? Did he have any kind of belief? Did he think everything was futile? Like, did they speak on that at all? Like, kind of like where his headspace was?
I think they spoke to the truth of his introverted and shy nature. They spoke to the truth of him being demanding and impossible at times, but also being a quick learner and learning how to communicate and finding, you know, I understand that when I get into a group of too many people, all the extroverted friend maker in me turns off and I become very shy and tight, quiet, and reserved because I'm overwhelmed. And I seem to recognize that in the way that they described him. Mm-hmm. And then he figured out how to like do the performance while maintaining his authenticity. But that pressure still overlaps between who they think you are and who you truly are.
Right.
And it seemed like he had spent an entire lifetime with his addictions jumping from thing to person to idea to work and never able at a healthy and reasonable time to stop and say like, I'm truly empty inside. I have to change. I have to heal. Like he didn't make any declarations of religious belief, but he talked about, they did a scene where he was like on a therapy couch and there was a woman interviewing him. And I can't tell what the purpose of that project was. Maybe it was like a clip from the show. Maybe I don't know why it was in there, mm-hmm. but she proposed to him, like, if you're feeling all of this absence, like you really should start asking yourself, are you actually willing to change the way you feel? You know, which I think is the thing that drives all of us to a therapist's office. It drives right. all of us to an urgent reaction. Like you can no longer stay like this. It gets you to the AA meeting, you know, like I can't do this anymore. Yeah. I got to be different. I think that he like, it seems like I could surmise that he circled around that truth, around that drain of like, if I go down this, I won't know who I am for a good long time. It's going to unbreak a lot of things, which is going to be very painful in the resetting. And I might not have any greater concept of who I am in this rebirth. So like, fuck it. Like right. it seemed like he wanted to and was reaching for an understanding of himself, and he did not seek out the avenues of healing that I know many of us are seeking out now, where it's mm-hmm. like, I will kill myself if I don't address what I know is immediately my greatest oppression.
Right.
And then further on, you know, like internal oppressions, those things that keep us quiet and small, you know. It seemed like he was grasping for it, but he never quite reached it. And it
right.
was.
And for the revenge aspect, do you think kind of taking, so he kind of made that post about the revenge movie, right? And if this is going to be his ultimate performance, do you think the revenge was like, I'm getting revenge on Aja, the woman that he was dating, who the tabloids made it out like she was cheating on him? Was it like, did he want to hurt her, or is he taking himself out of the equation? Because it's like, okay, now you can no longer have a piece of me. Like, I'm no longer going to give the world or this woman a piece of me to enjoy, right? Like, I'm taking myself out of the equation. Or do you think revenge in terms of like, I just want to hurt her for what she did to me? You know what I mean? Like, I wonder, did they allude to like where that revenge spark was aimed at?
I think the speculation surrounding it, the speculation and really talking about like the fine point of the day that they learned about his death or the emotions they feel around it. Some people straight up burst into tears. Other people did not want to talk about it. Those that did try to discuss it in an honoring fashion seemed to hold all of the truths at once. This is mental illness. This is a lifelong, you know, he was an addict very young. And, you know, he talked about.
Was he still using?
No. Yeah. You know, that's something they get really, somebody gets really angry about, is that his toxicology report said he was completely clean and sober. Mm-hmm. So it was a very intentional choice what he did. And I think what they're saying is that the complexity of a person is as real as the complexity of their manner of death, especially related to suicide. So in his way, he, you know, it seems like he felt tortured, and all the perfect storm happened, right? You have unchecked mental illness, you have long-term trauma or unhealed pain, a sense of not belonging, stress, overwhelm, and you make a snap judgment, right? Like you feel this crushing weight of like being unlovable. For me, I know that feeling of like another relationship is ending and just feeling like I'm obviously the problem because I can't find the love I'm seeking. And they alluded to the potential of him being manic. So like, you know, there's all these things that could be true, but without his own conscious investment in his experience, there's no way for him to like, for any of us to give him an identity he didn't claim.
Right.
So and it's just like, trailer, I think it all happened.
Yeah. And yeah, exactly. There, you can never just give a reason why, because like you said, it was a culmination of all of those things and all of these things that we'll never know. And they made it seem like, you know, he was always ready for the next thing. Okay. Like what's next? I'm on, you know, he was always willing to walk into the next thing. Right. And so it's like, if you're in a manic state, I could see that next logical step of like, okay, well, like what's next? And here's the next step. I'm stepping into this realm of death. I've went to all the parties. I went to all the islands, ate all the food. I'm heartbroken. And mix that with a dose of fucking depression and
futile. When they talk about him being in Beirut when a war broke out, and then because of him being, he was like trapped in a resort while there was an entire war happening in Beirut. Like they went there for food, a war broke out while they were there. And there's a footage of him, you know, because they're recording constantly every moment of his life for years. He makes this metaphor about like, we're hiding in this resort while there's a war going on. Like they're back to back. We're on the front lines, but we're by the pool kind of thing.
Right. Yeah.
And he was like, I don't think there's any greater metaphor for this whole life experience. And I don't think it didn't seem like he felt guilty about his level of fame and success. But like, I think there are a few things were at play that we recognize as true to our own experience. Like
he was recognizing his place, though. You know what I mean? How ridiculous that I come here with all my privilege and get to eat the local food, but I'm in the resort. I'm by the pool. The war is happening outside, but here I am in this bubble.
When he seemingly felt powerless to stop it or to help because none of the resources that he could provide in that moment would fix this. And I think that that's something that I know I've experienced, whether it's emotional support of another person or the outright heartbreak of like when you have to choose to take care of yourself over someone else, when you don't have $5 to give somebody on the corner because it's your last $5, or when you can't do anything to help your friends during a time of COVID, like, you know, you can't be there for the births or deaths in their life. You can't help them move. You can't, like, the restrictions and the fear of like, I could actually hurt you more by participating, all that to be true in that experience.
Right.
And they showed some instances where his attempted generosity went wrong. And so it was like, they showed the full truth of that spectrum. And also like, I know you know this feeling of like not wanting a home. Like at some point, I think we both were like, a roof over my head sounds like a prison cell.
Right, right.
I'm going to be on the road. And so they talked about him romanticizing this role of fatherhood, romanticizing this life experience in general, and then getting that itch that we start to get where you're like, I want to go on to the next thing. I want to do the next thing. Like the highest height of the dopamine and the oxytocin is wearing off and like on to the next place, on rushing. And I mean, as a person who has had to do significant therapy to learn how to slow down, because that was not the way my brain worked before neurofeedback, like I totally get wanting something so bad and being completely unable to be absorbed in it, to be unable to grasp it or to feel it. So when the kind of when the surface level joy of that wears away, just the chemical reaction to being home or being with your family wears off and you can't feel anything deeper than that, that you need the next hit.
Right.
You know, so this is like, this is so many, it's an artistic journey. It's an addict's journey. It's, you know, he's kind of, you know, from a rags to riches story, which I know our culture really loves. Mm-hmm. At the same time that they're like trying to drag you back down into the gutter kind of thing. It's, it was the complexities of a human life.
Yeah.
And it was just, it was, I don't know, that whole, the notion of revenge against, Asia was relevant because they didn't want to ignore his final messaging per se. Right. They didn't want to act like it didn't happen, but they were also saying like every aspect of this man that you can see is human, as human, that you related to showed up on that day when he made that decision. And there's nothing that any of us are capable of pretending is not true about that.
And to just talk about fucking how life informs your art. You know what I mean? Like, wow, that's heavy. That's beautiful. I do want to watch that whenever it's available to be watched. 'Cause I think there's a lot to be gained by watching a story like that. Mm-hmm. And multiple times too, because I kind of feel like you'll pick up on different meanings and messages, but obviously it's going to resonate differently with everybody, right? Like, I mean, we all have different reasons why we go to the page, right? And like you said, for our tipping point for going to therapy, I can no longer fucking feel this way anymore. Like, it's just not possible to live this way anymore, right? And I just think about that. It's like, you know, is it age? Am I just older now? So this is why I'm calmer. Is it the therapy? Is it the SSRI? Is it, you know what I mean? Like, what is it? Is it a combination of all of that? And like, where do I put that mania and that itch now? It's like, it all goes into the work. All goes into the page, right? Like, especially being forced to not be able to travel anymore because of COVID and lockdown and all this. It's like, traveling is like, okay, what's my next idea? What's the next story I'm getting down? How do I implement this? What kind of visual aspect, you know what I mean? Like, I literally have to get dressed up and like listen to certain songs to feel like I've gone somewhere and done something. You know what I mean?
Absolutely.
Like, there's no other way. I don't know what else to do with myself at this point.
I think that's the thing it's another element of that story and the collective story we're experiencing, right? Like anybody who's doing their part, whether they're doing it for the betterment of the collective or they're doing it because they have their own stake in it, immune compromised or what have you, there's the sense of the need to feel relevant and important that we all possess. And when everything has been stripped away from you, including your dignity, like how do you persevere? And I think that, you know, even now we've rolled into the second year of this pandemic. There's no signs of my life like returning to normal anytime soon. You know, like I've agreed to do one in-person gig because it's outside. And I've been on the fence about that the entire last week because of the Delta variant, because the news is like, put your fucking mask back on, stay home, breakthrough cases. Like it's infecting the vaccinated and the unvaccinated alike. Like I don't know how to respond to this. And I feel such a deep grief now. It's taken me a year.
Yeah,
and probably because in that year I had housing security and I had financial security with unemployment, neither of which I have now. The moratoriums have expired and Missouri cut federal unemployment aid. So I have no backup plan. And now I am feeling an even deeper grief. So what I know is that the privileged people who are still not experiencing the impact of this are still not truly experiencing the impact of this. The ignorant people are pretending that this isn't real and I don't know how to fix them. But my life is in the shitter. Like, I mean, there's a lot of great things about my life and I have a fucking great roof over my head that I can barely afford now. And there's no room for error for me. Like, you know, fall behind on one thing and the whole thing is going to fucking crumble.
Right.
So like the amount of pressure I think that we build on top of people to keep them independent and or ashamed of being asked for help is so enormous that it's still killing people every day. In every possible way it can touch people, that pressure for people to be enough for every situation it's so toxic, it's causing suicides.
Well, and also we're made to feel like it's our fault. You're an individual failure instead of this is a systemic issue and this is how the system is set up to make things so hard on people that they become addicts, they become homeless. They are, you know, victims of a very calculated fucking system that we live in called capitalism. Like, this doesn't have to be so hard on people. We could have housing for everybody. There is no reason why anybody should be without a home. Period.
Right. There's like, no housing shortage at all. There's tons of cities.
And there's no money fucking shortage. There's no shortage. This is all fucking manufactured. And so people might be able to get clean. People might be able to make better choices and might be able to, like, not want to fucking kill themselves if we didn't make it so fucking hard on them. But it's like sometimes, like, what else? You know what I mean? Even at that level, you know, I know we're talking about two different things because he was, you know, on the high end of the economic system and had all this privilege and yada, yada, yada. But it's like the pressure's still there. Wherever you're at in the system, it's still killing everybody.
The
pressure is still
resources.
Mounting. Right. Exactly.
Yeah. There's no relief for anyone. And that it's like if we're losing these icons of our time, as we have, I mean, we can, you know, Robin Williams is another example of this, like, a man who brings everybody joy, you know, having so much despair within him that he takes his own life. Like, there is a truth that we continue to ignore, which is that we are starving people for all resources. You know, these fucking fat cat governor pieces of shit that are sitting in their houses with their steady paychecks and their fucking governor's mansions and all the resources and shit they have. They don't feel the suffering that we're
and
suffering.
And their healthcare that we fucking pay for while they deny other people the resources for fucking healthcare.
Absolutely. And I mean, the governor of Missouri, who's, I won't give the dignity of naming because
he's the biggest piece of fucking shit in the world.
He's such a biggest piece of shit. He still has everything that he needs and he does not care about the people. If he cared about the people, he would take the most cautious level of opportunity available to him and he would apply it to everyone. And so, you know, he's not losing his home. He's not losing his paycheck. He's not losing his job. And there was something I shared the other day that said, there's not a labor shortage. There's a wage shortage. You want to know why people are continuing to collect federal unemployment on top of whatever regular unemployment they could get? It's because they're finally making enough money to be stable in their lives. And why would I trade in even something that will eventually end? Why would I trade it in sooner for something so much shittier? Like, I can't live. I got offered a full-time job at a nonprofit for $8 an hour last week. It took me 4 hours to prep my resume and my CV and all that shit for this job. And I applied for it. And I mean, they responded, honestly, they responded with what was available in that application. It's not like they picked me out to fuck me over, you know?
Yeah, no, but it's disgusting. But
I can't
live on that.
It's like it was like a $1,026 a month to live on. That's what they wanted
to
give me for 40 hours a week worth of
work. And this is another thing people aren't talking about that really fucking pisses me off. You know, they're like, oh, there is no labor shortage because you know what? Big corporations, instead of like the big wigs and the CEOs, like they don't lose anything. They still get their paycheck and their bonuses and this and that. The first thing they cut is wage labor. So they fired somebody at my work that had been there forever, had all this knowledge. I mean, was at an age where it's not going to be fucking easy for them to go out and get another job because they're like, okay, well, we need to cut money. And instead of cutting it from anywhere else, they immediately go for just the worker cut. That's the first thing they'll do. And if you stopped fucking doing that, if you just kept good workers, paid them a good raise, a good wage, and give them their yearly raises and stuff, it's like there's so many places where you can cut your fucking budget. It's always the salaried fucking wage workers, and that's it. And people are having enough of it. There is just enough.
Well, it's like at what point, when are we supposed to respond, and how are we supposed to respond? Because it's like, first of all, I am not a pacifist, but I don't want to incite violence that's going to result in the people that I care about being harmed. And I've been at enough queer protest rally or like queer rallies for LGBT marriage equality or abortion right access, like all of these things. And I've had my life threatened in every way by every possible form of authority. Like I have been tear gassed. I have been in the midst of cops being entirely vicious and cruel to the people that are paying their fucking salaries. Like, I've watched over my lifetime the militarization of our police forces. Like, I'm sure there are plenty of good cops out there that just want to go out and do the right thing and keep law and order.
But I'm sorry, you fucking signed up. You put the fucking uniform on and it represents something else now. And I'm sorry, fucking priest too. You want to put that fucking robe on? First thing that I'm going to think is a pedophile. You chose to put the fucking robe on. There is no just bad apple. At this point, this is an institution that is perpetuating harm and violence. So if you choose to be a part of it, I'm sorry. That's, you know what I mean? Like, I'm sure there's really good whoever's, but like it at some point it's no longer an individual choice, you know, as a worker. You are part of a gang that is doing harm to people. Like, end of story.
And if you're not willing to acknowledge the evolution of our society and our philosophies in that we need peacekeepers, caretakers, mental health resources, and resources in general, if you're not willing to evolve and adapt and advocate for those sorts of changes, if you want to cling with your dying breath to this grasp at power, that's a decision you make against the people who will eventually take you out.
And what do we do? You know, what do we do? Like, okay, we've all been protesting for years, right? I think it's important for visibility. I think it's important for raising awareness, XYZ. But like, there has to be a next level at some point. Like, protest in the street no longer is effective. Like, I don't know. And that's another thing that makes me feel so angry and helpless. And going back to like tying it in with like Bourdain feeling helpless. Okay, like my generosity try. Like, we try to donate all the money. We go to the protest. We're reading the right books, we're showing up, we're trying to do all these right things, right? But it's like, it's not enough. I cannot shop on Amazon all I want, but unless everybody stops shopping on Amazon, it's not going to make a fucking difference. Us not using straws and plastic anymore isn't going to do anything. These corporations and that make all this plastic and all the coal and all the, and unless they stop, nothing's going to change. So it's like, it's so futile and it's so fucking heavy. I can see how easily you get weighed down because you're like, no, there's nothing I can do that's going to make a fucking difference, right? Like, yes, I can be nice to my neighbor when I see them today, but like, that's the extent of like my effect on the fucking world. Because when you look at since it started to where we are now, like, we're all dealing with the same fucking problems.
Absolutely. I completely agree with you. I feel like we've learned nothing. You know, that's the greatest defeat of my 36 years. It's like, you know, we've talked about this before. I think at least in person, if not on the podcast, but like, you know, I was born in 85. So I graduated high school in 2003 and I was born in a recession. I graduated high school in a war followed by a recession. And then the housing market collapsed, the collapse of our entire economy, more recession than dump trucks fucking presidency and the full mockery of that it ever made to us on a global scale, much less the suffering and the death that impended with his experience. And now we're in a war with a virus and I am still being told that it's my fault. Yeah. No, it's not my fault. And
we're in a war with half of the fucking country who actively wants to kill people.
Yeah. The flames are being stoked for Rome to fall. And it's the most terrifying thing in the world to me to try and be on the side of progress, the side of everybody's safety and stability. Like, I don't want anybody excluded from universal healthcare. I don't want anybody excluded from universal income. I believe that it should be available for all of us. Right. And if you are present in this country for whatever reason that you got here, it should be a country of generosity and wealth and welcoming. And we should have a system in place to deal with people who commit crimes at any level. I recognize the need for structure, but I do not. I have spent my whole life trying to patch up all of these fucking holes that keep popping up in this boat. And I am done. Mm-hmm. This boat is going to fucking sink and I'm going to help it sink because I am suffering and struggling under the weight of this. And I have I have nieces that will come into this adult world in no time at all. And what is it that I'm offering them?
Yeah.
The goddamn ocean's on fire.
I know. My generation no clean drinking water. They will have nothing clean to eat or drink or breathe. And it's terrifying. It breaks my fucking heart on my friends that are having children right now. And it's like, you know, I would never question anybody's decision, but it's just like, it scares the fuck out of me. Like
we had a reader in a writer and a reader in the workshop a week or two ago. And I looked this up online. They wrote in their piece, like I read today, there are only 27 years of fish left in the ocean. And so I Googled that. And the full fact is basically that all of the things that we farm, that we regularly eat as seafood, have been so ravaged and so diminished by our large scale consumption that within our lifetime, it could literally be impossible to eat anything that was natural from the ocean ever again.
Absolutely. Because we live on a fine, there's only finite resources, right?
Right.
And with capitalism comes extraction and exploitation. And for some reason, these billionaires now think since they've ravaged this earth, they're going to go to space to extract it instead of like making this a sustainable place, which is 100% possible to make very large changes. With these billionaires' money, just the three billionaires, four billionaires I could name, could fix the rainforest, housing, food, air, what, like, you name it, and make this place a replenishable place. Instead of fixing this place, they want to go to Earth, make more extractions, and go fuck that place up. Like, it makes no sense.
The
level of destruction, like going into space, you know, they're going to extract all the resources and the minerals from space now because we've extracted everything from Earth, right? And so they're just going to go deplete here. It's like, the destructive mentality of that is so fucking sick. Like, you can have a sustainable and replenishable way of living. And like the fact that you refuse because you want power, you want money, you want exploitation. This is a choice to be harmful. Every day you wake up and say, how can I hurt as many people as possible today?
Yeah. Every fucking dollar that went into that fucking dick rocket could have been used to feed starving children.
What a sick fucking bastard. And he goes, I want to thank the Amazon workers. Yeah, because you stole all their fucking money and their time and their health. And you went up there to say woo-ha. He has like no fucking like ability. Like, I don't even think he's alive. I don't think Zuckerberg is alive. I don't think he's alive. And fuck Bill Gates and fuck Branson and fuck Elon and fuck all these billionaires that people think, ooh, one day maybe I could be a billionaire. It's like everyone is willing to fuck this world and fuck everybody else because like I might have the ability to get a piece of the pie one day. It's like, if you want to fucking suck Elon's dick, there's something wrong with you. Your values are fucked up. And until as a society, our value system changes, like, people only think your art is good if you're making money. People only think you're a valid person if you're on social media. The mental illness is so far beyond my capacity to like even entertain and interact with anymore that like I can't handle it. Like I don't want to participate. And it makes me go like, okay, well, the only way I can take myself out of this oversaturated bullshit is to not publish, is to not produce, is to not participate. Like I could just sit here and do nothing in my little hermit crab shell and extend nothing because it's like, I'm insufficiently commercial. You know what I mean? Hands down. Like, I don't make money, so I'm not real. I'm not valid. I don't, you know, Ashley, insufficiently commercial. He's not seen as a valid partner or worker because his music doesn't make money. And people only value people if you have a lot of money. Somehow, if you have money, you're good. And if you don't have money, you're bad. And I don't believe that.
I don't believe it either. I completely agree with you. I am insufficiently commercial is so important to honor because I think that it conjures like a rallying cry. It's like, I don't want to be a part of this anymore. I got on social media because it was a way to keep track of the minute details of my friends' lives where, you know, they wanted to post a picture of a day in the park with their kids and I want to be happy for them. So I like it. It is not a place where we foster any of the best parts of the human experience anymore. It is not. I was talking to a couple of parents about the behaviors of their like teenagers and preteens in this time, just because now I'm fucking curious. I want to know what the hell kids are doing and how they're behaving and what their expectations are, what the world is like for them. Like, I don't think about these things very often because my head's up my own ass, but like, they talked about how the primary desire for their kids at this point, like, you know, 11 to 18, is becoming TikTok famous. And I was just like, what have we done to our society with all of these tools that have become now systemic players that we've taught everyone they're not important. We've taught everyone that they're not special unless they have an audience for their talents. We taught all of them that they don't have to be a contributing member of society to any degree. We've told all of them that they are both the most important and entirely invisible all at once. All we've done is foster egos and an absolute lack of identity rooted in anything that really matters to the collective experience. I don't understand. And I don't think it's the parents' fault, because I'm talking to parents that I really love and respect and I recognize right. have been dealing with these evolutions in their children's lives as they've been happening in their own lives. So, like, you know, it's trial by fire. You learn as you go. But, like, how were they supposed to know that being on the phone that came to fruition in their lifetime, that those lights would be harmful, that somebody behind the scenes was directly programming it to engage and entice and addict their psychology? Nobody fucking right. thought that.
And even when the parents are instilling a different value system in the kids, that's still the culture and the world that they live in, and you can't escape it, right? So my dad tried to teach me to be modest and to, you know, not do drugs. I mean, all the great value systems that, like, a loving parent instills in you. I became, like, the sluttiest, druggiest, like, you know what I mean? Like, all of the values he tried to instill in me, like, I balked in whatever was of my time, and in the 90s I did, right? So it's like,
right.
even if these kids are growing up in a family with different values, they can't escape it. They cannot escape the TikTok.
No, well, they can't escape any of the social media impact or aspects, because if they are not in, they're out. And that's the thing, right? We have all of these classic movies of our generational time and before that, where you find your gang of people that are really, like, validating your shit. And we know, having lived quite a few lives in our lifetime, that sometimes you're friends with all the fucking goths, and sometimes you're friends with all the druggies, and sometimes you get to hang out with the nerds, which it turns out is fucking great because they're so full of information. And, you know, whatever it is, that kind of scope of people, I remember being available to me, and I also remember being available to them, mm-hmm. that I never wanted to have a singular type of friend group, that I never right. wanted to be the kind of person who was closed off to the experience of others, whether that was local or global, you know, regardless of race and gender and orientation. I wanted to know what people were like. I think that's part of what makes me a writer.
Yeah, absolutely.
But I have watched the de-evolution of our species curiosity, of our common humanity and love and respect for each other in this kind of pursuit of fame and visibility that I am not only disgusted by, but I can't quite understand. I can't quite understand how we got here. Like, I know there's so many things happening at once, but, like, how did we train our children by no intentional fault of our singular own, but as a collective, how did we train future generations that they only matter if everybody is behind them?
And if everybody is the same, Jen, there is no texture anymore. From the literal standpoint of, they all use filters that smooth your face out to the point where, like, there's no texture on your face. Like, faces have markings and, like, there's no texture, literally, because they're using these, like, weird filler filters. Then everything is done online, so you're never even, you don't have, there's nothing tangible anymore. Like, texture in terms of looks, in terms of, like, mind, there's no critical thinking. Like, there's no texture anymore to anything. There's no senses. It's very strange. I don't understand how we became this blank, puffy canvas.
I don't get it either. And I'm, you know, I think that, first of all, I want other people to talk to us about this. You know what I mean? It feels really interesting to explore the how the fuck did we wind up here, you know? And I mean, I would love for people to write us or email us or message us on fucking social
I know.
Media.
I wish that we were live and on radio and had a big audience so we could, like, take phone calls now and patch in people so they could give us their take.
That's the aspiration, because we're going to have to live off the grid and we're only going to have, like, an AM radio station. So we're just going to have to bring people in and...
Our 100-watt solar panel that we're trying to live out of in the back of the fucking Honda.
I can't get any Wi-Fi to broadcast this to the world about how fucked up everything is. You know, it's a bigger problem because it is so systemic and so insidious, and it's so nuanced and philosophical and just, like, deeply disturbing to me. But it is... I mean, it's in tying back to the ultimate thing that I think people are currently, like, resonating around with Bourdain's death is the manner of his death, right? And I think that the world wants to remember people in one very specific way. Mm-hmm. And they want to be able to put their thumb on it to understand it, and they want to simplify it down to its most basic origin. And I think that perpetuates in every aspect. The reason we have filtered, puffy, fucking, you know, blank slate faces is because we don't want to stand out. We don't want to other. We don't want to be seen for all of our vulnerabilities. We don't want to be ridiculed or sidelined or overlooked. So you're trying to, like, as a species, be the best of the species, I guess. And our psychology and our innate human behavior do not, like, they don't actually align.
Yeah.
Because our psychology is impacted by the culture that we function with it. And, you know, I can't imagine being a kid right now with all that pressure and all that expectation on them to, like, have the fattest ass and can twerk and dance and you know, play, you know, at musical instruments at the highest level. And, like, they're demanded to be so many things. Like, it's like everybody's an independent circus.
Right.
And they're only actually important if other people tell them they're important.
How many ways can you exploit one person?
Well,
and we're exploiting ourselves now. Like, capitalism is so inherent that we're our own bosses now. So someone becomes an entrepreneur. So now you're the boss and you're exploiting your fucking self. You don't even need the boss anymore because we just do it to ourselves inherently now.
Well, and we've also created the lack of civil discourse. We also, you know, I think we did this positive intentionally that we told people, like, you know, if people are giving you shit for being yourself, like, you should just keep being yourself. Keep doing you, boo. Like, it was an encouraging thing to teach kids resilience.
Right.
And it's been flipped on its head as a way for ignorant, uninformed, psychopathic, narcissistic people to validate their own behaviors, where they're like, I'm not wrong about not being vaccinated. You're all sheep. I'm getting more haters, so I'm preaching louder. I'm, you know, and it's like, no. Yeah. Everybody's coming to tell you that you're fucked up and you're fucking stupid and you need to get informed. They're not coming to create some sort of opposition or adversity in your life that should further dig your heels in. When everybody's telling you that you're being an asshole, you're being an asshole.
Right.
That's not motivation for you to remain the same. That's the biggest red flag that you need to fucking change.
It's gone to such an extreme level that it's like, I just feel like George Carlin at this point. It's like, the point of humans is plastic and I can no longer participate and I'm just on the sidelines and all I can do at this point is just be the observer.
I agree. And may he rest in peace.
We love you, George. God of mine. Okay, so we just talked about we started with Bourdain, we're ending with Carlin. I do want to hear everyone's opinion. I think this is a great start to this new season of revenge and redemption and what that looks like in our lives, what that looks like in our artwork. And yeah.
Let's fucking see what happens.
Let's do it.
All right. Season 3 is going to happen.
Whoop, whoop. Whoop, whoop. Thanks for listening to Confessing Animals. Make sure you subscribe wherever you get your podcasts and leave us a review so more people can find us. And if you want to support the show or get access to the extended video casts, join us on Patreon, confessinganimalspodcast.com.